It wasn't Mamma Mia or Jersey Boys, perhaps, and it wasn't Cirque du Soleil, but in its day, it was really big.
Yes, while Hollywood went to the dance in 1964, Las Vegas is still the place for the big shows, the gaudy musicals, the big reviews. And this show caused a virtual rebuilding of the Tropicana's huge theater restaurant to accommodate such special effects as carousels dropping from the ceiling, complete with life-size horses and gorgeous girl riders.
That's from a newsreel about the relaunch of the Folies Bergères show in 1963. The show is still playing, but with one big difference. Today, there is no live orchestra. That change came in 1989, and this year is the 25th anniversary of a strike that dragged on for months. Picket lines formed outside the Strip's biggest casinos, even though it was 100 degrees or more every day. The lines were still in front of the hotels after Christmas. And to tell us more about the bitter strike are three veterans of that walkout in 1989. Mark Massagli was president of Local 369 when the strike happened. Mark, welcome to KNPR.
Thank you.
Bruce Armstrong was also here. He was a band leader at the City Lights show at the Flamingo. Bruce, welcome.
Thank you.
And Ron Simone was playing in a band at the Tropicana when the strike came. Juan, Ron, welcome to KNPR.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
So, Ron Simone, how did the strike start? What was the origin of this action?
I don't know anything because I was playing steady at the Tropicana six nights a week. The union was negotiating with the hotels. And the hotels brought in, my God, I'll never forget, Larry Levian. You guys remember Larry?
Yes, indeed.
He was a union buster is what he was. That's what he was brought in for. But, you know, it wasn't too surprising to me at the time because it wasn't just that the hotels, to me, wanted to cut back on money, which they always do to this present day, but it was also the fact that the music itself was changing. And because of the star shows, you had like Sinatra, these other people, all of a sudden you had people of the younger stars coming in that had different kind of music that didn't require the same big bands. So I knew inevitably sooner or later that was going to happen, to change.
Now, Mark Massagli, you were leading the union. Did you have any kind of a warning sign that the big hotels were going to make this demand?
No, I didn't. But in an earlier negotiation for our federation, we met with a fellow that had an ice show, believe it or not, and we met with him in Los Angeles, and he mentioned the name Larry Levian. He said, "Have you met Larry Levian?" I said, "No, I haven't." He said, "Well, you'll be meeting him soon." Somehow this fellow knew Levian, the attorney that was hired. So there was no indication prior to our sitting down at the negotiating table that they were going to push for this replacement of live players.
So specify for us the replacement of live players with taped music?
Yes, pre-recorded.
Pre-recorded music.
Yes.
So they didn't want you playing the live music anymore.
Right. And one of the things that we said while we were on picket is we would say the majority of the people that come here to Vegas come to the entertainment capital of the world, and they expect to see bands, music, live players. They're going to be very disappointed if you get your way if the bands have been replaced by a recording. And the recordings they already had, in some cases, were made in Europe. And so that's how they had it backed up to take care of that contingency, should it happen.
Now, for those of us who did not come to Vegas in the 80s or before, give us an idea of the size of musical ensembles. I mean, when you're talking about live musicians, how many were we talking about here?
Generally, a minimum of 13, 14.
So large. These are large orchestras. This is not like a trio or a duo.
No, not in the main showrooms. Mm-hmm.
And how many of these orchestras were there? Where did you find them?
There were, I think, 12 hotels that we negotiated with. And not only the players that were playing in the regular house bands, but the relief bands that would play the seventh night, there were added musicians to playing those things. So those different shows.
So you ultimately went on strike. How did it spread to the other strip hotels? You said there were 12 with which you negotiated.
Right. There were 12 with whom we had collective bargaining agreements, which includes a couple of downtown. What happened was we struck the Tropicana June 3rd, 1989. That was the first place that we struck. It was by action of our board of directors at the union to call that strike. Consequently, each strike action was a board action of our union by those fellows that were players. They were all gentlemen in those shows. So when it didn't stop the resort association from yielding in their practice, we said, well, let's show them we're serious. Let's strike at another one. And we did. Eventually, it was Tropicana, Caesars, Hilton, Bally, Las Vegas, Flamingo. Mm. So we had five picket lines going 24 hours a day. And we had help from so many people. My wife, my sons both walked the picket line. My wife walked every day at the Tropicana. Mm. And many of us, the musicians and the union people, our families helped and supported the strike and their spouses in this matter.
Now, Bruce Armstrong, you were leading the band at the Flamingo.
Yeah, at that
time. What kind of show were you playing for?
It was it's what they call a production show. We had and it was very much centered around ice skating.
So what sort of music did you play for?
Well, we played all kinds of music, you know. I mean, we played whatever was appropriate to the scenes that were on stage. I mean, we also had interim acts in addition, you know, they would change around, you know, jugglers and, you know, magicians and that type of thing. So we would play their music. But, you know, we had major production numbers that were, you know, standard tunes and special material for the show. And it was, those of us on production shows, and I think Mark and Ryan will agree, we used to call that music by the pound sometimes. It was straight ahead, you know. but it was great. I mean your chops were you had to be right on top of it, and you know when you came to work every night, you knew that you know, it was going to be a wall-to-wall affair, and you know, it was great.
Was this transition to taped music, was it something that came suddenly, or were you kind of aware that this was out there
in
the distance?
Mark is, you know, he was much more and had his ear to the ground, maybe more than we playing musicians. But I did have a curious thing happen. I had good friends in Atlantic City, and they got in touch with me and said, hey, you know, there's some rumors out here that they want to use taped music, you know, on production shows. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, Atlantic City was kind of an odd duck in those days, and I thought, well, that's not going to happen in Las Vegas. Boy, was I wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't think that would come to pass. It just didn't seem that it would happen. Of course, history proved me wrong.
Mm. So Ron Simone, the Tropicana was the first hotel where the picket lines were walked. What was it? Had you been in a picket line before? Had you ever been out on strike before?
No, I hadn't. No.
What did you make of all of this?
Well, the only thing is they told us to be there the next day with a picket sign. And those of us that were in a house orchestra at Tropicana, they gave us $300 a week. I guess it was, I don't know if that was the unemployment scale at the time or whatever, but that was our pay, that we had to get out there and picket every night.
What do you do when that happens? I mean, do you just kind of swallow hard and then look for the picket sign? What did you think when you found out that that's what you were going to be doing?
And for me, in some respects, I kind of dug it for a couple of weeks because, you know, I had some time off. But, you know, I was more fortunate than a lot of the other guys because being a piano player, piano players are in demand, especially with production shows.
Yeah. You told the Las Vegas Sun in June of 89, as the strike got underway, that you thought the tourists and visitors were, as you put it, entitled to the best entertainment in the country. What did you think would go wrong with the taped music?
Tapes can break. And it happened. Really, I mean, mm-hmm. the acts that are doing their bits on stage, so much of it what we call sight cues, where there's a start and there's a stop. And I remember particularly people like Cremo, the juggler guy at the Lido, who drove us totally insane because we never knew what he was going to be doing because he didn't know himself. But how the heck could a tape do that?
Yeah, you got to watch the performer and take your musical cues.
Well, proof of the pudding was that I had rehearsed the Siegfried and Roy production show, which is called Beyond Belief. 8 of the worst weeks of my life rehearsing that show. And I'll never forget that they had the orchestra all set to play that show. They were playing it. Then when they went on strike, they said they were going to hire another orchestra to record the show. And I don't know where they went and what they did, but I know they had 92 hours of rehearsals before these guys could learn that show. That was the difference. Okay.
One other orchestra member named Tom Wright told his son that the orchestra had to do as you were describing. You cover up mistakes from the dancers or others. You improvise upon.
Yeah, Tom was with us at the Tropicana.
Yeah, right. And a tape recorder couldn't do that. So I did this put the performers on edge as well?
Yeah, of course, and they let us know it too, you know, because I knew all the kids at the show. I had rehearsed them, you know.
We are talking about the musician strike in Las Vegas in 1989. It's now been 25 years since Local 369 struck the hotel's showrooms to keep taped music out. We are talking with Mark Massagli, who was the president of Local 369 when the strike occurred. Ron Simone played keyboard at the Folies Bergère at the Tropicana where the strike began. And Bruce Armstrong was band leader at the Flamingo, leading the orchestra that accompanied the ice show City Lights. So, Bruce Armstrong, what happened at the Flamingo? Did musicians at other resorts think they had to join the strike in order to avoid being replaced?
Well, no, but we, as union members, we all did a certain amount of time on the Tropicana line.
Right.
At that time, it was the only picket line. And so we all participated. You know, we picketed X number of hours a day to keep that line up for 24 hours.
So, Mark Massagli, how did tourists react? Did they care if there was a live orchestra in the showrooms? Did they just walk by the picket lines?
We put out petitions asking the question of the visitors. Do you appreciate that you now, in some cases in this establishment, may be listening to tape music rather than live music? That's what this strike is about. And I think we got something like 62,000 signatures that we sent to the governor of the state at that time. And people were not happy with it. Of course, others will say no and then just go anyway. But particularly at Bally's, Bally's was not Bally's at its opening. It was MGM.
MGM,
right?
MGM, yeah.
And when the show came in, the Don Arden show came in there, the band could not be seen.
Right.
The band was not in view. And when that happened, the light went out. I said, if they can't see us, they're going to say they don't need us. And it took a few years, but that's where they ended up. Mm. And one of the other things that happened with the recordings, which they got again in Europe, was they even attempted a proposal that, okay, we'll use you guys to make the recordings. So that's like saying you can stab yourself with your own knife.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to be out of work and you put yourself out of work. So that didn't go anywhere.
Mm. What about other performers in other shows? Did you ask them to join?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes.
Sure. So what kind of response did you get?
Very good. Mm. Very good. I can give you a few names. Frank Sinatra, 3 times during the strike. Dean Martin, and he was not well, and his manager said, please, guys, get it over with. He said, I got a man dying on a couch at home.
Right.
You know, and Anne Murray, stars of all every caliber that supported Burt Bacharach, Dionne Warwick. And the support was really great. And George Carlin was a funny one. He was not a musician. He didn't really need any music, but he didn't want to cross the picket line at Caesars, and he stayed out twice. Finally, he had an opportunity to go in again, and he called me up and he said, Mark, I got to go. The IRS is after me. I need the money.
Oh,
and
dear.
So I said, man, you've been great. Mm. You're not
Bill
using
Bill Cosby, too, wasn't it?
Yeah, Cosby.
I think Dangerfield was another guy that was
Rodney,
he had that show, that club over there.
That's
yeah,
right.
He shut that
right.
down, man.
Yeah, Rodney.
I had a lot of respect for him.
Rodney used to call me 2-3 times a day, you know. He was unbelievable, boy.
He sure was.
But they supported us very well, these people.
Well, as we know, the strike ultimately did not succeed. You had to agree to the hotel's terms, and that changed the way that music was used in so many showrooms on the Strip. When did you know that the strike was lost, that you weren't going to prevail?
Well, we had, during the strike and one shortly after that, we had four suicides, members of this union. People had, with the greatest abilities, had to go working for car rental agencies. And these are people with their degrees from universities and schools of music playing as the best players in the world. When those people had to either leave town or take some other employment that was not music, these professional musicians, our board, which was comprised of all musicians, said, look, we've been beaten up enough, and it cost our local $1,200,000 and almost broke us. And we said, they said they were going to kill us. We fought back. We hurt them in financial ways. But I think it's time to call it quits. And we negotiated a settlement for those that were the regular players that were displaced. And we got a settlement for them that was equivalent to about a year's pay.
Mm. It was fair.
Yeah. Mm. Mm.
So what do musicians do after something like that? The settlement, the year's pay or thereabouts. And what happened to all of your lives? How did they change when this was finally resolved?
Well, probably best from Bruce.
Bruce Armstrong?
Well, actually, I sold my house and I moved to Los Angeles to get my master's degree in music and teach. And I wound up being at UCLA. I wound up retiring from UCLA about 2 years ago, but it changed my life. However, when I was in LA, I continued to play. I even ran into people occasionally from some of the acts and so forth that I knew out here in Las Vegas. But yeah, I mean, I basically just decided, you know, and I was fortunate because I was still somewhat young enough that I could make a change like that. Some of the older men, that was going to be a little bit tough. You know, that was very tough for them. Yeah. And I think a lot of people eventually left town.
Were you still able to find – could you find gigs in Los Angeles?
I did, but I mean, it wasn't the same. I was working, you know, just casuals and club dates and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Ron Simone?
Yes.
What changed for you when this was finished? What happened?
I was explaining to the guys before. After I had been picketing for a couple of weeks, the band leader at the Stardust Hotel, Bill Newkirk, he had suffered an aneurysm. So his piano player had to take over conducting. And they asked me to go in and substitute on piano for the Lido show. And I spent the next 7 months there playing the Lido show. And I was very fortunate that when the contract was finally, you know, when the strike finally ended, I went into Caesar's Palace the very next day with the house orchestra, Johnny Haig, at Caesar's Palace. So I was fortunate. For me, it was not that bad a thing.
So what did we lose when this era effectively closed, when a lot of these casinos did away with live music?
Probably 250 steady jobs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Culturally, what was lost? What died?
I don't know if there's a parallel that you can draw to that. You know, the shows were star policy shows or production shows. Now we seem to have a different mix. I think there are either four or five circus shows. It's a production show, of course, but that's different, and it's smaller bands.
It seems sort of ironic that this is 1989 is sort of the dawn of so many building booms and economic booms here, and yet that's the time when it appeared as though the pool of musicians and live music available shrank.
Sure.
I mean, do you look at that and just see a lot of irony to that?
Well, I do because I've been here since 1957. Mm. And when I first came here, I believe there were less than 60,000 people in Clark County. And so I was able to see that growth coming and everywhere, downtown, on the Strip, more homes, And it looked like it was good. I had no desire to go anywhere else, and I could work here. But construction of a hotel doesn't generate it by itself. Okay, now we've got 25 musicians working. It doesn't. It didn't work that way, and it doesn't work that way. Because when the old guys used to own the hotels, the old guys, they thought very horizontally. I'll lose money on food, booze, entertainment, hotel, but if I get them in the building, I'll make it on the tables. As opposed to then the structure of the corporate mentality, which was vertical. The food and beverage has to pay for itself, and the hotel has to pay, and so forth. So they really put the pencil to entertainment. Entertainment brought them in, but can you say because this guy came in, we're going to hire another player here? It didn't work that way. We created the ambience of the beauty of Las Vegas entertainment.
Mm. Ron Simone?
I could support what Mark is saying. He's saying that the original owners of the hotels, they knew how to cater to the gamblers. Let me give you an example. In 1966, when I left the Riviera showroom, I went into the Desert Inn Monte Carlo restaurant, and it was a gourmet restaurant, and the hotel was owned by Mo Dalitz. And we were a duo, just myself and Joe Mack. And we were there for 5 years playing. And the room was 90% comp. This gives you an idea of the clientele that came in there. So all of a sudden, Howard Hughes comes in and takes over the top floor of the hotel. And he had his whole entourage with him. And we knew it was just a question of time before Howard Hughes was going to take over the hotel. And he finally made the bosses an offer they couldn't refuse. And so they sold the hotel to Howard Hughes. The very next day, our room, the Monte Carlo restaurant, went from a 90% comp to 10% comp. Okay? And all of a sudden, they bring in a guy who was a railroad executive to run the hotel. And we're looking around. We saw the entire clientele change. Hmm. All these big gamblers, they said, heck, we're going to go to the dunes. We're going to go to Riviera. We're going to go to the Sands. You know, we're going to go where they know how to take care of us. And that was the whole change.
The writing on the wall right there.
You couldn't miss it.
Yeah. Ron Simone was a keyboard player and strike leader at the Tropicana Hotel and Casino during the 1989 strike. Bruce Armstrong was a band leader at the Flamingo Hotel and Casino at that time. And Mark Mesegli was president of Local 369 of the American Federation of Musicians. Gents, so great to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Welcome.
Yeah, thank you for having us.